Hello, welcome to The Wire, where fresh coverage of independent news and current affairs from right around Australia comes to you on your local community radio station. I'm Roderick Chambers in Sydney, and coming up on the program today...
People want to know that when they are hit with an emergency, they're going to be able to call 000 and they'll be able to get through.
With trust in major telcos declining, younger people are now turning back to using landlines as a form of communication. This follows the outages we've had on 000 in recent months, making people rethink their reliance on their mobile phone. Also coming up on the program...
The readers here really have an important role to play. So they will have to also take the initiative to learn more about the media landscape, to cultivate their media literacy and AI literacy.
The introduction of AI overviews in search engines are eroding online news readership, putting the responsibility on audiences to ensure that they get the correct answers. Or will people just prioritise convenience over accuracy? We find out here on The Wire, so stay tuned. Australian diplomatic staff in Israel have reported serious mistreatment of Australian activists involved in attempting to breach Israel's naval blockade of Gaza. The claims of maltreatment also included physical beatings. Now appears that all seven Australian citizens have been deported from Israel to Jordan. A spokesperson for Foreign Minister Penny Wong said the government was pleased that they have been released from detention. James Bale asked Associate Professor Srinjoy Bose from the University of New South Wales how the flotilla could have expected to be able to break through the Gaza blockade.
Not just the Israeli Navy, it's the Israeli administration. Their strategic motive is to punish people who disagree with Israel and are outspoken about the genocide against Palestinians. Individuals such as the Minister of National Security, Ben-Gvir, repeatedly conflated Hamas with Palestinians, the implication being all Palestinians are terrorists. By extension, their logic is that anyone who supports Palestinians and or speaks out against the Israeli genocide is a supporter of terrorism, thereby giving them the necessary justification to detain activists, peace activists, who were part of the Sukkot flotilla. So that's the overall strategic rationale.
Would Israelis' use of torture tactics, which were in the report, so there was physical violence, no access to bathrooms, would this be considered a war crime?
This entire episode detracts away from the genocide against Palestinians and the treatment of Palestinians in Israeli prisons, more often than not without charge, without trial, right? The treatment of Palestinians in and Palestinian children in Israeli prisons is now well documented. The use of torture, sexual assault is commonplace, which would be in contravention to the human treatment of prisoners, regardless of whether they are charged as prisoners of war or otherwise. So that's, I think, the real issue.
Also in this report, it was claimed that a Israeli soldier tore up the passport of one of the Australian activists. So how would a country hypothetically respond to that?
I suppose what this demonstrates is that consular support by nations is paramount. The Australian administration is responsible for its citizens overseas. In other words, whether the administration agrees or disagrees with the viewpoints and, in this instance, the actions of peace activists who are part of the flotilla, Australia is responsible to its citizens. So what it needs to do with regard to allegations of torture or human rights abuse, of destruction of passports, which is government property, Australia needs to obviously ensure its citizens are protected from those harms, potential or real.
How can the Australian government respond further to what's happening beyond destruction of government property?
In a way, this is a result of the international community allowing the state of Israel to get away with crimes against humanity at scale. This is an extension of that, an extension of the international community's complicity. What that means is if you've allowed Israel to get away with genocide, crimes against humanity, they will feel the confidence to get away with other sorts of wrongdoing, which includes the mistreatment of Australian peace activists. I'm not entirely sure the Australian government and administration is now in a position to do much because they have allowed the Israeli state to get away with much, much worse.
Associate Professor Srinjoy Bose, Associate Professor in International Relations at the School of Social Sciences, University of New South Wales, speaking there with James Bale.
Hey there, I'm Hamish McDonald. Around Australia, you're listening to The Wire. Take it easy.
It has been 1 year since Google launched AI Overviews in Australia, which has added AI-generated summaries for over a third of the results that you search for. Today, Google has launched their new AI mode, a search setting similar to Chatbot, which generates conversational answers to queries. Google CEO Sundar Pichai spoke about this new AI technology.
This whole new dedicated AI experience called AI mode coming to search. And in AI mode, you can have a full-on AI experience in search, including follow-on conversational queries. People are typing in queries, like literally long paragraphs. So we are seeing people respond. We kind of know what works. Users are our North Star. And empirically, we see that people are engaging more and using the product more.
With AI being increasingly relied upon to answer our questions, online news sites are seeing a decrease in readership. Amelia Crouch asked RMIT researcher Dr. Joanne Kwai how the introduction of AI in Google's search engine has eroded how we search for information.
So these generative search engines, they will reduce the incentive for the users and audience to click through, and because they present synthesized answers directly on the search page, so they inevitably cut traffic to the publishers.
Have you encountered any unreliable kind of search results as a result of these summaries?
Yes, because these generative search engines, they're built on large language models, which are probabilistic models. They are not designed to provide accurate, verifiable information. So the research I've done previously have shown that these systems, they were cite sources, they were just wrong, and they will make up quotations and even misattribute or fabricate. So they will create an appearance of transparency, but actually undermining like these trustworthy news outlets.
So if these results are so unreliable, why do you think we give them such authority?
From the user's perspective, it's more because of the convenience. You will look at the synthesized answers and don't have much incentive to click through and just trust them to take them for their face value.
So how would, say, this user experience affect the credibility and ability for, say, online journalism?
The readers here really have an important role to play. So they will have to also take the initiative to learn more about the media landscape, to cultivate their media literacy and AI literacy, and question what they see, where is the information coming from, who are talking, and cultivate a better news habits and also their news diet so they can support quality journalism and also support them even financially.
So that's what audiences can do. What could the media possibly do to help adapt to this?
As of now, the media is really at a disadvantage, especially the smaller newsrooms or even freelance journalists. They don't have any leverage and power when it comes to negotiating deals with these big platforms. They can neither negotiate a good deal, a sign license agreement, or have any kind of like power over them. So it's a really grim picture for the media outlet. But the journalists, it's still not completely hopeless. They can try to diversify their offerings, such as newsletters or podcasts, so to create more direct engagement with the audience and to build this like trust relationship with their audience. So to stand out by having this quality journalism and trustworthy news to stand out for their brand building.
Amelia Crouch speaking there with Dr. Joanne Kawai, an RMIT researcher focusing on AI, search engines and journalism. Hello, if you're listening to The Wire in Wild Scotsman's Country on 4GGO in Gingin, or 7RPH in Hobart, or 3BBB in the Gold Rush city of Ballarat. In an age dominated by smartphones and high-speed internet, a surprising research is brewing. With the latest 000 outage, trust in major telco providers is declining, and now more people are turning back to the landline for their source of communication, especially in emergencies. Once considered obsolete, these relics are finding new life amongst consumers craving reliability, privacy, and simple contact in a digital world. Thomas Kutis asked Carol Bennett, CEO of the Australian Communications Consumer Action Network, just what factors are driving interest in landline phones.
Well, I think with recent outages, particularly with two in the past couple of weeks, consumer confidence has really been shattered, particularly in the 000 system. And people want to know that when they are hit with an emergency, they're going to be able to call 000 and they'll be able to get through. And clearly, this ongoing sort of discussion and debate around whether the 000 system works or doesn't work, and in what circumstances you need to have it, you know, an app to back up your access to emergency system or a landline, or whether you need to have multiple providers. I mean, these have all been ongoing discussions in the Australian community in recent weeks. And I guess the issue is we really need to shore up confidence in the system that's there rather than ask consumers to make a workaround, because it shouldn't be up to them to have to try and ensure that they can access 000 when they need it.
How has the decline of trust in mobile and internet providers influenced consumer behaviour around communication technology?
I think it has influenced behaviour. I think people feel as though they need multiple providers, as though they have to provide their own backup system. So I've heard from people in the regions, for instance, that they feel that they've got to have Starlink rather than other systems that might be more affordable because they're worried about connectivity. But the same sort of thing applies with mobile phones. I mean, people are concerned that if in their family there are three Optus phones, for instance, and Optus is out and there's no access to 000, they might need a Telstra one as well, because there have been those sorts of discussions ongoing in the public debate.
And with this resurgence of landline phones, what regions are you seeing this in mostly, and particularly like the age groups and the type of people?
Yeah, look, we understand there has been a bit of a resurgence amongst younger people, and I think...
Oh, really? I always thought the older people used the...
I think it's the older people encouraging younger people to revert back to the system they used to use that they knew was reliable. And I think when people are feeling a bit undermined in their confidence in the system working for them, and mobiles maybe not being as assured as they thought they were, they're now thinking, well, our best option is to go back to basics. I'm not sure that's the answer, to be honest. I think You know, landlines and payphones are of a bygone era, really. And yes, we've got the infrastructure, the terrestrial infrastructure that enables those connections to continue. But the future direction is really going to be that plus satellite to mobile or satellite to device technology, which will enable, you know, text messaging, voice messaging, and eventually data. So I'm not sure that the landline option is necessarily more secure than having, you know, multi systems that enable people to connect.
But many people do say it's very reliable and it's more a secure form of connecting compared to mobile networks. What would you say to that?
Well, I think if there's the terrestrial infrastructure in place, then definitely it is a very secure option. There's no doubt about that. But, you know, I guess there's the security of having multiple layers of these things. So if the terrestrial networks go out, and we know they do in weather emergencies, for instance, the power goes out or,
yes,
you know, lines are, you know, destroyed, or, you know, there's water saturation of, you know, pits that carry the wires to homes and that sort of thing. I mean, there are always these sorts of contingencies. And I guess that's the environment we live in at the moment. We've got multiple challenges and we need to be able to meet those. So it's about sort of getting the mix of services and capability that will meet the broadest possible needs around Australia. And it's a geographically challenging country to service as well. So that's another factor.
So do you think that this resurgence is going to be a temporary one, or quite possibly could be permanent?
Look, it can be a permanent thing. It's not, we would like to see ongoing investment in the terrestrial networks. So, I mean, I think as far as we can see at the moment, that will continue to be the case. And certainly, you know, the telcos are required to invest in those networks and will continue to do so, even if we have satellite to mobile technology. So that's a pretty good option, and it's an option we'd like to keep because it's a security blanket. But we also want to see the other safety nets, and having, you know, that mobile to device technology is going to be an important safety net, as will mobile roaming for emergency services.
All right, Carol Bennett, thanks for your time.
Thanks so much, Thomas.
Carol Bennett, CEO of the Australian Communications Consumer Action Network, speaking there with Thomas Cooters.
Hi, I'm Ray Martin. You're listening to The Wire on community and Indigenous radio right across Australia. Stay well.
Gold prices have hit record highs, surpassing the $6,000 an ounce mark for the first time. Many people will be eyeing off their parents' jewellery, wondering what it would now be worth. And the gold rush isn't just happening in global markets. At the Perth Mint, more than 7,500 customers have queued each week in the past fortnight, many lining up to buy gold bars as stocks run short. Susan Hu asked Dr. John O'Donoghue, General Manager of the Depository at the Perth Mint, what were the main global forces driving gold to such record highs right now?
There's a number of forces in the market that are driving gold to record highs. If you look at the US, there's concerns about the current government shutdown. there's an impact of the tariffs that came into force previously and how they will play out on the economic strength. There's also uncertainty as to how many interest rate reductions will happen this year. So all those factors, coupled with global factors, is driving people to gold, which is the safe haven asset.
Yeah, so as you mentioned, gold's often seen as a safe haven during turbulent times. Does that reputation still hold true today? And how do we see that playing out?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I think the answer is yes, gold is still classified and considered a safe haven asset. If you look back over the last 2 years, we've had a lot of uncertainty across the world, be it geopolitical, be it conflicts in various regions. That has propelled people to gold. And then secondly, central banks are buying gold at record levels. And all those factors definitely resonate to the wider community that gold is still the safe haven asset.
Here in Australia, we're seeing people queue outside the Perth Mint to buy gold bars. What does that tell us about public sentiment and confidence in the economy?
I think that's twofold. So gold has definitely become more common across the narrative. If you look back over the last number of months, the price of gold is reported in most of the major news bulletins. It's reported in the paper. It's gaining more traction. So I think that's making more people aware of gold. And as more people buy, there's a momentum trade that happens. And that, I think, brings more people to the party.
Gold is one of Australia's largest exports. What does that mean for the gold industry and for the Perth Mint's operations?
Yeah, gold has been one of the strongest resources in Australia, especially in West Australia. Here at the Perth Mint, we export the majority of our gold around the world. That has been the case for many years, and that will continue to be the case. That continues to support jobs locally in the community.
Some analysts warn prices could fall back. Do you see this as a sustainable shift or more of a speculative bubble?
If you look at the broader market, there could be some short-term selling where people would take profits as it has hit record highs in US dollar terms and AUD terms in the last couple of days. So you might see some short-term profit-taking. But looking more longer term, most of the analysts predict that gold will continue to be at an elevated level for the medium term.
Aligning with this trend in soaring gold prices, what other resources or minerals do we see with this following a similar trend?
Yeah, gold is attracting a lot of the headlines, but additionally, silver and platinum have both had a really strong performance in 2025. Silver has hit record highs in Australian dollar terms. It's trading over 70 Australian dollars. And platinum has rallied very hard in the last number of months. It's now trading over 1,500 US dollars. Both of these metals are additionally performing like gold.
What do you think explains the forces driving this? Is it the same reasons as gold?
So silver has probably two factors at play. One is it's also considered a safe haven asset, but not to the same extent as gold. And then secondly, silver has an industrial element. So both of those factors are combining to drive the price higher at the minute. And platinum has underperformed for the last number of years compared to gold. So a lot of the upswing in platinum at the minute is more than likely driven by catching up to underperformance.
John O'Donoghue, General Manager of the Depository at the Perth Mint, speaking there with Susan Hu. And that's it for The Wire today. You can find all of our stories online at thewire.org.au or subscribe to our podcasts. Just look for The Wire Radio. Today's program came from the studios of Radio 2 SER 107.3 here in Sydney and broadcast around the nation on the Community Radio Network. In Sydney, The Wire is produced on Gadigal country of the Eora Nation and with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. We're going to be back again tomorrow, so do tune in again then. I'm Roderick Chambers. Do stay well and thanks for your company.